Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week is the final episodes of Winesburg, Ohio, by Sherwood Anderson, Sophistication and Departure. Anderson has saved his best for last. I think you'll find the final scene in Winesburg very touching. These last two stories are rather short, so I thought it might be interesting to go back and listen to the first story, the introduction. So I've included it at the end for you. I hope you've enjoyed our journey to a little Midwestern town in Ohio. And now, Sophistication, concerning Helen White. It was early evening of a day in late fall, and the Winesburg County Fair had brought crowds of country people into town. The day had been clear, and the night came on warm and pleasant. On the Trunnion Turnpike, where the road, after it left town, stretched away between berry fields now covered with dry brown leaves, the dust from passing wagons arose in clouds. Children, curled into little balls, slept on the straw scattered on wagon beds. Their hair was full of dust, and their fingers black and sticky. The dust rolled away over the fields, and the departing sun set it ablaze with colors. In the main street of Winesburg, crowds filled the stores and the sidewalks. Night came on, horses whinnied, the clerks in the stores ran madly about. Children became lost and cried lustily. An American town worked terribly at the task of amusing itself. Pushing his way through the crowds in Main Street, young George Willard concealed himself in the stairway leading to Dr. Reefy's office and looked at the people. With feverish eyes, he watched the faces drifting past under the store lights. Thoughts kept coming into his head, and he did not want to think. He stamped impatiently on the wooden steps and looked sharply about. "Well, is she going to stay with him all day? Have I done all this waiting for nothing?" he muttered. George Willard, the Ohio village boy, was fast growing into manhood, and new thoughts had been coming into his mind. All that day, amid the jam of people at the fair, he had gone about feeling lonely. He was about to leave Winesburg, to go away to some city where he hoped to get work on a city newspaper, and he felt grown up. The mood that had taken possession of him was a thing known to men and unknown to boys. He felt old and a little tired. Memories awoke in him. To his mind, his new sense of maturity set him apart, made him a half-tragic figure. He wanted someone to understand the feeling that had taken possession of him after his mother's death. There is a time in the life of every boy when he for the first time takes the backward view of life. Perhaps that is the moment when he crosses the line into manhood. The boy is walking through the street of his town. He is thinking of the future and of the figure he will cut in the world. Ambitions and regrets awake within him. Suddenly something happens. He stops under a tree and waits as for a voice calling his name. Ghosts of old things creep into his consciousness. The voices outside of himself whisper a message concerning the limitations of life. From being quite sure of himself and his future, he becomes not at all sure. If he be an imaginative boy, a door is torn open, and for the first time he looks out upon the world, seeing, as though they marched in procession before him, the countless figures of men who before his time have come out of nothingness into the world, lived their lives, and again disappeared into nothingness. The sadness of sophistication has come to the boy. With a little gasp, he sees himself as merely a leaf blown by the wind through the streets of his village. He knows that in spite of all the stout talk of his fellows, he must live and die in uncertainty. A thing blown by the winds, a thing destined, like corn, to wilt in the sun. He shivers and looks eagerly about. The 18 years he has lived seem but a moment, a breathing space in the long march of humanity. Already he hears death calling. With all his heart, he wants to come close to some other human, touch someone with his hands, be touched by the hand of another. If he prefers that the other be a woman, that is because he believes that a woman will be gentle, that she will understand. He wants, most of all, understanding. When the moment of sophistication came to George Willard, his mind turned to Helen White, the Winesburg banker's daughter. Always he had been conscious of the girl growing into womanhood as he grew into manhood. Once, on a summer night when he was 18, he had walked with her on a country road and in her presence had given way to an impulse to boast, to make himself appear big and significant in her eyes. Now he wanted to see her for another purpose. He wanted to tell her of the new impulses that had come to him. He had tried to make her think of him as a man when he knew nothing of manhood. And now he wanted to be with her and to try and make her feel the change he believed had taken place in his nature. As for Helen White, she also had come to a period of change. What George felt, she in her young woman's way felt also. She was no longer a girl, and hungered to reach into the grace and beauty of womanhood. She had come home from Cleveland, where she was attending college, to spend a day at the fair. She also had begun to have memories. During the day, she sat in the grandstand with a young man, one of the instructors from college, who was a guest of her mother's. The young man was of a pedantic turn of mind, and she felt at once he would not do for her purpose. At the fair, she was glad to be seen in his company, as he was well-dressed and a stranger. She knew that the fact of his presence would create an impression. During the day, she was happy, but when night came on, she began to grow restless. She wanted to drive the instructor away, to get out of his presence. While they sat together in the grandstand, and while the eyes of former schoolmates were upon them, she paid so much attention to her escort that he grew interested. "A scholar needs money. I should marry a woman with money," he mused. Helen White was thinking of George Willard, even as he wandered gloomily through the crowds thinking of her. She remembered the summer evening when they had walked together and wanted to talk with him again. She thought that the months she had spent in the city, the going to theaters and the seeing of great crowds wandering in lighted thoroughfares, had changed her profoundly. She wanted him to feel and be conscious of the change in her nature. The summer evening together that had left its mark on the memory of both the young man and woman had, when looked at quite sensibly, been rather stupidly spent. They had walked out of town along a country road. Then they had stopped by a fence near a field of young corn, and George had taken off his coat and let it hang on his arm. "Well, I've stayed here in Winesburg, yes. I've not gone away, but I'm growing up," he had said. "I've been reading books, and I've been thinking. I'm going to try to amount to something in life." "Well," he explained, "that isn't the point. Perhaps I'd better quit talking." The confused boy put his hand on the girl's arm. His voice trembled. The two started to walk back along the road toward town. In his desperation, George boasted, "I'm going to be a big man, the biggest that ever lived here in Winesburg," he declared. "I want you to do something. I don't know what. Perhaps it is none of my business. I want you to try to be different from other women. You see the point. It's none of my business, I tell you. I want you to be a beautiful woman. You see what I want." The boy's voice failed, and in silence the two came back into town and went along the street to Helen White's house. At the gate, he tried to say something impressive. Speeches he had thought out came into his head, but they seemed utterly pointless. "I used to think, I had it in my mind you would marry Seth Richmond. Now I know you won't, was all he could find to say as she went through the gate and toward the door of her house. On the warm fall evening, as he stood in the stairway and looked at the crowd drifting through Main Street, George thought of the talk beside the field of young corn and was ashamed of the figure he had made of himself. In the street, the people surged up and down like cattle confined in a pen. Buggies and wagons almost filled the narrow thoroughfare. A band played, and small boys raced along the sidewalk, diving between the legs of men. Young men with shining red faces walked awkwardly about with girls on their arms. In a room above one of the stores, where a dance was to be held, the fiddlers tuned their instruments. The broken sounds floated down through an open window and out across the murmur of voices and the loud blare of the horns of the band. The medley of sounds got on young Willard's nerves. Everywhere, on all sides, the sense of crowding, moving life closed in about him. He wanted to run away by himself and think.
She wants to stay with that fella, she may. Why should I care? What difference does it make to me?
He growled and went along Main Street and through Hearn's Grocery into a side street. George felt so utterly lonely and dejected that he wanted to weep, but pride made him walk rapidly along, swinging his arms. He came to Wesley Moyer's livery barn and stopped in the shadows to listen to a group of men who talked of a race Wesley's stallion Tony Tip had won at the fair during the afternoon. A crowd had gathered in front of the barn, and before the crowd walked Wesley, prancing up and down, boasting. He held a whip in his hand and kept tapping the ground. Little puffs of dust arose in the lamplight.
"Hell, quit your talking," Wesley exclaimed. "I wasn't afraid. I knew I had him beat all the time. I wasn't afraid."
Ordinarily, George Willard would have been intensely interested in the boasting of Moyer, the horseman. Now it made him angry. He turned and hurried away along the street.
"Old windbag," he sputtered. "Why does he want to be bragging? Why don't he shut up?"
George went into a vacant lot, and as he hurried along, fell over a pile of rubbish. A nail protruding from an empty barrel tore his trousers. He sat down on the ground and swore. With a pin, he mended the torn place, and then arose and went on.
"I'll go to Helen White's house. That's what I'll do. I'll walk right in. I'll say that I want to see her. I'll walk right in and sit down. That's what I'll do,"
he declared, climbing over a fence and beginning to run. On the veranda of Banker White's house, Helen was restless and distraught. The instructor sat between the mother and daughter. His talk wearied the girl. Although he had also been raised in an Ohio town, the instructor began to put on airs of the city. He wanted to appear cosmopolitan.
"I like the chance you have given me to study the background out of which most of our girls come," he declared. "It was good of you, Mrs. White, to have me down for the day."
He turned to Helen and laughed.
"Your life still bound up with the life of this town?" he asked. "There are people here in whom you are interested."
To the girl, his voice sounded pompous and heavy. Helen arose and went into the house. At the door, leading to a garden at the back, she stopped and stood listening. Her mother began to talk.
"There is no one here fit to associate with a girl of Helen's breeding," she said.
Helen ran down a flight of stairs at the back of the house and into the garden. In the darkness, she stopped and stood trembling. It seemed to her that the world was full of meaningless people saying words. Afire with eagerness, she ran through a garden gate and, turning a corner by the banker's barn, went into a little side street.
"George, where are you, George?"
she cried, filled with nervous excitement. She stopped running and leaned against a tree to laugh hysterically. Along the dark little street came George Willard, still saying words.
"I'm going to walk right into her house. I'll go right in and sit down,"
he declared as he came up to her. He stopped and stared stupidly.
Come on, he said, and took hold of her hand. With hanging heads, they walked away along the street under the trees. Dry leaves rustled underfoot. Now that he had found her, George wondered what he had better do or say. At the upper end of the fairground in Winesburg, there is a half-decayed old grandstand. It has never been painted, and the boards are all warped out of shape. The fairground stands on top of a low hill rising out of the valley of Wine Creek, and from the grandstand, one can see at night, over a cornfield, the lights of the town reflected against the sky. George and Helen climbed the hill to the fairground, coming by the path past Waterworks Pond. The feeling of loneliness and isolation that had come to the young man in the crowded streets of his town was both broken and intensified by the presence of Helen. What he felt was reflected in her. In youth, there are always two forces fighting in people. The warm, unthinking little animal struggles against the thing that reflects and remembers, and the older, more sophisticated thing had possession of George Willard. Sensing his mood, Helen walked beside him, filled with respect. When they got to the grandstand, they climbed up under the roof and sat down on one of the long, bench-like seats. There is something memorable in the experience to be had by going into a fairground that stands at the edge of a Middle Western town on a night after the annual fair has been held. The sensation is one never to be forgotten. On all sides are ghosts, not of the dead, but of living people. Here, during the day just past, have come the people pouring in from the town and the country around, farmers with their wives and children, and all the people from the hundreds of little frame houses have gathered within these board walls. Young girls have laughed, and men with beards have talked of the affairs of their lives. The place has been filled to overflowing with life. It has itched and squirmed with life, and now it is night, and the life has all gone away. The silence is almost terrifying. One conceals oneself standing silently beside the trunk of a tree, and what there is of a reflective tendency in his nature is intensified. One shudders at the thought of the meaninglessness of life, while at the same instant, and if the people of the town are his people, one loves life so intensely that tears come into the eyes. In the darkness under the roof of the grandstand, George Willard sat beside Helen White and felt very keenly his own insignificance in the scheme of existence. Now that he had come out of town where the presence of the people stirring about, busy with a multitude of affairs, had been so irritating, the irritation was all gone. The presence of Helen renewed and refreshed him. It was as though her woman's hand was assisting him to make some minute adjustment of the machinery of his life. He began to think of the people in town where he had always lived with something like reverence. He had reverence for Helen. He wanted to love and to be loved by her, but he did not want at the moment to be confused by her womanhood. In the darkness, he took hold of her hand, and when she crept close, put a hand on her shoulder. A wind began to blow, and he shivered. With all his strength, he tried to hold and to understand the mood that had come upon him. In that high place in the darkness, the two oddly sensitive human atoms held each other tightly and waited. In the mind of each was the same thought. I have come to this lonely place, and here is this other, was the substance of the thing felt. In Winesburg, the crowded day had run itself out into the long night of the late fall. Farm horses jogged away along lonely country roads, pulling their portion of weary people. Clerks began bringing samples of goods in off the sidewalk and locked the doors of stores. In the opera house, a crowd had gathered to see a show, and further down Main Street, the fiddlers, their instruments tuned, sweated and worked to keep the feet of youth flying over the dance floor. In the darkness in the grandstand, Helen White and George Willard remained silent.
Now and then the spell that held them was broken, and they turned and tried in the dim light to see into each other's eyes. They kissed, but that impulse did not last. At the upper end of the fairground, a half dozen men worked over horses that had been raced during the afternoon. The men had built a fire and were heating kettles of water. Only their legs could be seen as they passed back and forth in the light. When the wind blew, the little flames of the fire danced crazily about. George and Helen arose and walked away into the darkness. They went along a path past a field of corn that had not yet been cut. The wind whispered among the dry corn blades. For a moment during the walk back into town, the spell that had held them was broken. When they had come to the crest of Waterworks Hill, they stopped by a tree, and George again put his hands on the girl's shoulders. She embraced him eagerly, and then again they drew quickly back from that impulse. They stopped kissing and stood a little apart. Mutual respect grew big in them. They were both embarrassed, and to relieve their embarrassment dropped into the animalism of youth. They laughed and began to pull and haul at each other. In some way chastened and purified by the mood they had been in, they became not man and woman, not boy and girl, but excited little animals. It was so they went down the hill. In the darkness, they played like two splendid young things in a young world. Once, running swiftly forward, Helen tripped George and he fell. He squirmed and shouted. Shaking with laughter, he roiled down the hill. Helen ran after him. For just a moment, she stopped in the darkness. There was no way of knowing what woman's thoughts went through her mind. But when the bottom of the hill was reached, and she came up to the boy, she took his arm and walked beside him in dignified silence. For some reason they could not have explained, they had both got from their silent evening together the thing needed. Man or boy, woman or girl, they had for a moment taken hold of the thing that makes the mature life of men and women in the modern world possible. And now, departure. Concerning George Willard. Young George Willard got out of bed at 4 in the morning. It was April, and the young tree leaves were just coming out of their buds. The trees along the residence streets in Winesburg are maple, and the seeds are winged. When the wind blows, they whirl crazily about, filling the air and making a carpet underfoot. George came downstairs into the hotel office, carrying a brown leather bag. His trunk was packed for departure. Since 2 o'clock, he had been awake, thinking of the journey he was about to take, and wondering what he would find at the end of his journey. The boy who slept in the hotel office lay on a cot by the door. His mouth was open, and he snored lustily. George crept past the cot and went out into the silent, deserted main street. The east was pink with the dawn, and long streets of light climbed into the sky where a few stars still shone. Beyond the last house on Trunnion Pike in Winesburg, there is a great stretch of open fields. The fields are owned by farmers who live in town and drive homeward at evening along Trunnion Pike in light, creaking wagons. In the fields are planted berries and small fruits. In the late afternoon, in the hot summers, when the road and the fields are covered with dust, a smoky haze lies over the great flat basin of land. To look across it is like looking out across the sea. In the spring, when the land is green, the effect is somewhat different. The land becomes a wide green billiard table on which tiny human insects toil up and down. All through his boyhood and young manhood, George Willard had been in the habit of walking on Trunnion Pike. He had been in the midst of the great open place on winter nights when it was covered with snow, and only the moon looked down at him. He had been there in the fall, when bleak winds blew, and on summer evenings when the air vibrated with the song of insects. On the April morning, he wanted to go there again, to walk again in the silence. He did walk to where the road dipped down by a little stream 2 miles from town, and then turned and walked silently back again. When he got to Main Street, clerks were sweeping the sidewalks before the stores.
"Hey, you George, how does it feel to be going away?" they asked.
The westbound train leaves Winesburg at 7:45 in the morning. Tom Little is conductor. His train runs from Cleveland to where it connects with a great trunk line railroad with terminals in Chicago and New York. Tom has what in railroad circles is called an easy run. Every evening he returns to his family. In the fall and spring, he spends his Sundays fishing in Lake Erie. He has a round face and small blue eyes. He knows the people in the towns along his railroad better than a city man knows the people who live in his apartment building. George came down the little incline from the new Willard house at 7 o'clock. Tom Willard carried his bag. The son had become taller than the father. On the station platform, everyone shook the young man's hand. More than a dozen people waited about. Then they talked of their own affairs. Even Will Henderson, who was lazy and often slept until 9, had got out of bed. George was embarrassed. Gertrude Wilmot, a tall, thin woman of 50 who worked in the Winesburg post office, came along the station platform. She had never before paid any attention to George. Now she stopped and put out her hand. In 2 words, she voiced what everyone felt.
"Good luck,"
she said sharply, and then turning, went on her way. When the train came into the station, George felt relieved. He scampered hurriedly aboard. Helen White came running along Main Street, hoping to have a parting word with him, but he had found a seat and did not see her. When the train started, Tom Little punched his ticket, grinned, and although he knew George well and knew on what adventure he was just setting out, made no comment. Tom had seen 1,000 George Willards go out of their towns to the city. It was a commonplace enough incident with him. In the smoking car, there was a man who had just invited Tom to go on a fishing trip in Sandusky Bay. He wanted to accept the invitation and talk over details. George glanced up and down the car to be sure no one was looking, then took out his pocketbook and counted his money. His mind was occupied with a desire not to appear green. Almost the last words his father had said to him concerned the matter of his behavior when he got to the city.
"Be a sharp one," Tom Willard had said. "Keep your eyes on your money. Be awake. That's the ticket. Don't let anyone think you're a greenhorn."
After George counted his money, he looked out of the window and was surprised to see that the train was still in Winesburg. The young man, going out of his town to meet the adventure of his life, began to think, but he did not think of anything very big or dramatic. Things like his mother's death, his departure from Winesburg, the uncertainty of his future life in the city, the serious and large aspects of his life did not come into his mind. He thought of little things. Turk Smollett, wheeling boards through the main street of his town in the morning. A tall woman, beautifully gowned, who had once stayed overnight at his father's hotel. Butch Wheeler, the lamplighter of Winesburg, hurrying through the street on a summer evening and holding a torch in his hand. Helen White, standing by a window in the Winesburg post office and putting a stamp on an envelope. The young man's mind was carried away by his growing passion for dreams. One looking at him would not have thought him particularly sharp. With the recollection of little things occupying his mind, he closed his eyes and leaned back in the car seat. He stayed that way for a long time, and when he aroused himself and again looked out the car window, the town of Winesburg had disappeared, and his life there had become but a background on which to paint the dreams of his manhood. And now, The Book of the Grotesque. The writer, an old man with a white mustache, had some difficulty in getting into bed. The windows of the house in which he lived were high, and he wanted to look at the trees when he awoke in the morning. A carpenter came to fix the bed so that it would be on a level with the window. Quite a fuss was made about the matter. The carpenter, who had been a soldier in the Civil War, came into the writer's room and sat down to talk of building a platform for the purpose of raising the bed. The writer had cigars lying about, and the carpenter smoked. For a time, the two men talked of the raising of the bed, and then talked of other things. The soldier got on the subject of the war. The writer, in fact, led him to that subject. The carpenter had once been a prisoner in Andersonville prison and had lost a brother. The brother had died of starvation, and when the carpenter got upon that subject, he cried. He, like the old writer, had a white mustache, and when he cried, he puckered up his lips, and the mustache bobbed up and down. The weeping old man with the cigar in his mouth was ludicrous. The plan the writer had for the raising of the bed was forgotten, and later the carpenter did it his own way, and the writer, who was past 60, had to help himself with a chair when he went to bed at night. In his bed, the writer rolled over on his side and lay quite still. For years he had been beset with notions concerning his heart. He was a hard smoker, and his heart fluttered. The idea had got into his mind that he would sometime die unexpectedly, and always when he got into bed he thought of that. It did not alarm him. The effect, in fact, was quite a special thing, and not easily explained. It made him more alive, there in bed, than at any other time. Perfectly still he lay, and his body was old and not of much use any more. But something inside him was altogether young. He was like a pregnant woman, only that the thing inside him was not a baby, but a youth. No, it wasn't a youth. It was a woman, young, and wearing a coat of mail like a knight. It is absurd, you see, to try to tell what was inside the old writer as he lay on his high bed and listened to the fluttering of his heart. The thing to get at is what the writer or the young thing within the writer was thinking about. The old writer, like all of the people in the world, had got, during his long life, a great many notions in his head. He had once been quite handsome, and a number of women had been in love with him. And then, of course, he had known people, many people, known them in a peculiarly intimate way that was different from the way in which you and I know people. At least, that is what the writer thought, and the thought pleased him. Why quarrel with an old man concerning his thoughts? In the bed, the writer had a dream that was not a dream. As he grew somewhat sleepy but was still conscious, figures began to appear before his eyes. He imagined the young, indescribable thing within himself was driving a long procession of figures before his eyes. You see, the interest in all this lies in the figures that went before the eyes of the writer. They were all grotesques. All of the men and women the writer had ever known had become grotesques. The grotesques were not all horrible. Some were amusing, some almost beautiful. And one, a woman, all drawn out of shape, hurt the old man by her grotesqueness. When she passed, he made a noise like a little dog whimpering. Had you come into the room, you might have supposed the old man had an unpleasant dream, or perhaps indigestion. For an hour, the procession of grotesques passed before the eyes of the old man. And then, although it was a painful thing to do, he crept out of bed and began to write. Some of the grotesques had made a deep impression on his mind, and he wanted to describe it. At his desk, the writer worked for an hour. In the end, he wrote a book which he called The Book of the Grotesque. It was never published, but I saw it once, and it made an indelible impression on my mind. The book had one central thought that is very strange and has always remained with me. By remembering it, I have been able to understand many people and things that I was never able to understand before. The thought was involved, but a simple statement of it would be something like this. That in the beginning, when the world was young, There were a great many thoughts, but no such thing as a truth. Man made the truths himself, and each truth was a composite of a great many vague thoughts. All about in the world were the truths, and they were all beautiful. The old man had listed hundreds of the truths in his book. I will not try to tell you all of them. There was the truth of virginity, and the truth of passion, the truth of wealth and poverty, of thrift and of profligacy, of carelessness and abandon. Hundreds and hundreds were the truths, and they were all beautiful. And then the people came along. Each, as he appeared, snatched up one of the truths, and some who were quite strong snatched up a dozen of them. It was the truths that made the people grotesques. The old man had quite an elaborate theory concerning the matter. It was his notion that the moment one of the people took one of the truths to himself, called it his truth, and tried to live his life by it, he became a grotesque, and the truth he embraced became a falsehood. You can see for yourself how the old man, who had spent all of his life writing and was filled with words, would write hundreds of pages concerning this matter. The subject would become so big in his mind that he himself would be in danger of becoming a grotesque. He didn't, I suppose, for the same reason that he never published the book. It was the young thing inside him that saved the old man. Concerning the carpenter who fixed the bed for the writer, I only mentioned him because he, like many of what are called very common people, became the nearest thing to what is understandable and lovable of all the grotesques in the writer's book. Hans, concerning Wing Biddlebaum. Upon the half-decayed veranda of a small frame house that stood near the edge of a ravine near the town of Winesburg, Ohio, a fat little man walked nervously up and down. Across a long field that had been seeded for clover, but that had produced only a dense crop of yellow mustard weeds, he could see the public highway along which went a wagon, filled with berry pickers returning from the fields. The berry pickers, youths and maidens, laughed and shouted boisterously. A boy, clad in a blue shirt, leaped from the wagon and attempted to drag after him one of the maidens, who screamed and protested shrilly. The feet of the boy in the road kicked up a cloud of dust that floated across the face of the departing sun. Over the long field came a thin, girlish voice. "Oh, you Wing Biddlebaum, comb your hair! It's falling into your eyes!" commanded the voice to the man, who was bald, and whose nervous little hands fiddled about the bare white forehead as though arranging a mass of tangled locks. Wing Biddlebaum, forever frightened and beset by a ghostly band of doubts, did not think of himself as in any way a part of the life of the town where he had lived for 20 years. Among all the people of Winesburg, but one had come close to him. With George Willard, son of Tom Willard, the proprietor of the new Willard House, he had formed something like a friendship. George Willard was the reporter on the Winesburg Eagle, and sometimes in the evenings he walked out along the highway to Wing Biddlebaum's house. Now, as the old man walked up and down on the veranda, his hands moving nervously about, he was hoping that George Willard would come and spend the evening with him. After the wagon containing the berry pickers had passed, he went across the field through the tall mustard weeds and climbed a rail fence, peering anxiously along the road to the town. For a moment he stood thus, rubbing his hands together and looking up and down the road, and then, fear overcoming him, ran back to walk again upon the porch on his own house. In the presence of George Willard, Wing Biddlebaum, who for 20 years had been the town mystery, lost something of his timidity, and his shadowy personality, submerged in a sea of doubts, came forth to look at the world. With the young reporter at his side, he ventured into the light of day into Main Street, or strode up and down on the rickety front porch of his own house, talking excitedly. The voice that had been low and trembling became shrill and loud. The bent figure straightened. With a kind of wriggle, like a fish returned to the brook by the fisherman, Biddlebaum the Silent began to talk, striving to put into words the ideas that had been accumulated by his mind during long years of silence. Wing Biddlebaum talked much with his hands, the slender expressive fingers forever active, forever striving to conceal themselves in his pockets or behind his back, came forth and became the piston rods of his machinery of expression. The story of Wing Biddlebaum is a story of hands. Their restless activity, like unto the beating of the wings of an imprisoned bird, had given him his name. Some obscure poet of the town had thought of it. The hands alarmed their owner. He wanted to keep them hidden away, and looked with amazement at the quiet, inexpressive hands of other men who worked beside him in the fields, or passed driving sleepy teams on country roads. When he talked to George Willard, Wing Biddlebaum closed his fists and beat with them upon a table or on the walls of his house. The action made him more comfortable. If the desire to talk came to him when the two were walking in the fields, he sought out a stump or the top board of a fence, and with his hands pounding busily, talked with renewed ease. The story of Wing Biddlebaum's hands is worth a book in itself. Sympathetically set forth, it would tap many strange, beautiful qualities in obscure men. It is a job for a poet. In Winesburg, the hands had attracted attention merely because of their activity. With them, Wing Biddlebaum had picked as high as 140 quarts of strawberries in a day. They became his distinguishing feature, the source of his fame. Also, they made more grotesque an already grotesque and elusive individual. Winesburg was proud of the hands of Wing Biddlebaum, in the same spirit in which it was proud of Banker White's New Stone House, and Wellesley Moyer's bay stallion, Tony Tip, that had won the 2:15 trot at the fall races in Cleveland. As for George Willard, he had many times wanted to ask about the hands. At times, an almost overwhelming curiosity had taken hold of him. He felt that there must be a reason for their strange activity and their inclination to keep hidden away, and only a growing respect for Wing Biddlebaum kept him from blurting out the questions that were often in his mind. Once he had been on the point of asking. The two were walking in the field on a summer afternoon and had stopped to sit upon a grassy bank. All afternoon, Wing Biddlebaum had talked as one inspired. By a fence he had stopped and, beating like a giant woodpecker upon the top board, had shouted at George Willard, condemning his tendency to be too much influenced by the people about him. "You are destroying yourself," he cried. "You have the inclination to be alone and to dream, and you are afraid of dreams. You want to be like others in town here. You hear them talk, and you try to imitate them." On the grassy bank, Wing Biddlebaum had tried again to drive his point home. His voice became soft and reminiscent, and with a sigh of contentment, he launched into a long, rambling talk, speaking as one in a lost dream. Out of the dream, Wing Biddlebaum made a picture for George Willard. In the picture, men lived again in a kind of pastoral golden age. Across a green open country came clean-limbed young men, some afoot, some mounted upon horses. In crowds, the young men came to gather about the feet of an old man who sat beneath a tree in a tiny garden and who talked to them. Wing Biddlebaum became wholly inspired. For once, he forgot the hands. Slowly, they stole forth and lay upon George Willard's shoulders. Something new and bold came into the voice that talked. "You must try to forget all you have learned," said the old man. "You must begin to dream. From this time on, you must shut your ears to the roaring of the voices." Pausing in his speech, Wing Biddlebaum looked long and earnestly at George Willard. His eyes glowed. Again he raised his hands to caress the boy, and then a look of horror swept over his face. With a convulsive movement of his body, Wing Biddlebaum sprang to his feet and thrust his hands deep into his trouser pockets. Tears came to his eyes. "I must be getting along home. I can talk no more with you," he said nervously. Without looking back, The old man had hurried down the hillside and across a meadow, leaving George Willard perplexed and frightened upon the grassy slope. With a shiver of dread, the boy arose and went along the road toward town. "I'll not ask him about his hands," he thought, touched by the memory of the terror he had seen in the man's eyes. "There's something wrong, but I don't want to know what it is. His hands have something to do with his fear of me and of everyone." And George Willard was right. Let us look briefly into the story of the hands. Perhaps our talking of them will arouse the poet who will tell the hidden wonder story of the influence for which the hands were but fluttering pennants of promise. In his youth, Wing Biddlebaum had been a schoolteacher in a town in Pennsylvania. He was not then known as Wing Biddlebaum, but went by the less euphonic name of Adolf Myers. As Adolf Myers, he was much loved by the boys of his school. Adolf Myers was meant by nature to be a teacher of youth. He was one of those rare, little-understood men who rule by a power so gentle that it passes as a lovable weakness. In their feeling for the boys under their charge, such men are not unlike the finer sort of women in their love of men. And yet, that is but crudely stated. It needs the poet there. With the boys of his school, Adolf Myers had walked in the evening or had sat talking until dusk upon the schoolhouse steps, lost in a kind of dream. Here and there went his hands, caressing the shoulders of the boys, playing about the tousled heads. As he talked, his voice became soft and musical. There was a caress in that also. In a way, the voice and the hands, the stroking of the shoulders and the touching of the hair, were part of the schoolmaster's effort to carry a dream into the young minds. By the caress that was in his fingers, he expressed himself. He was one of those men in whom the force that creates life is diffused, not centralized. Under the caress of his hands, doubt and disbelief went out of the minds of the boys, and they began also to dream. And then the tragedy. A half-witted boy of the school became enamored of the young master. In his bed at night, he imagined unspeakable things, and in the morning went forth to tell his dreams as facts. Strange, hideous accusations fell from his loose-hung lips. Through the Pennsylvania town went a shiver. Hidden, shadowy doubts that had been in men's minds concerning Adolf Myers were galvanized into beliefs. The tragedy did not linger. Trembling lads were jerked out of bed and questioned.
"He put his arms about me," said one. "His fingers were always playing in my hair," said another.
One afternoon, a man of the town, Henry Bradford, who kept a saloon, came to the schoolhouse door. Calling Adolf Myers into the schoolyard, he began to beat him with his fists. As his hard knuckles beat down into the frightened face of the schoolmaster, his wrath became more and more terrible. Screaming with dismay, the children ran here and there like disturbed insects.
"I'll teach you to put your hands on my boy, you beast!"
roared the saloon keeper, who, tired of beating the master, had begun to kick him about the yard. Adolf Myers was driven from the Pennsylvania town in the night. With lanterns in their hands, a dozen men came to the door of the house where he lived alone and commanded that he dress and come forth. It was raining, and one of the men had a rope in his hands. They had intended to hang the schoolmaster, but something in his figure, so small, white, and pitiful, touched their hearts, and they let him escape. As he ran away into the darkness, they repented of their weakness and ran after him, swearing and throwing sticks and great balls of soft mud at the figure that screamed and ran faster and faster into the darkness. For 20 years, Adolf Myers had lived alone in Winesburg. He was but 40, but looked 65. The name of Biddlebaum he got from a box of goods seen at a freight station as he hurried through an eastern Ohio town. He had an aunt in Winesburg, a black-toothed old woman who raised chickens, and with her he lived until she died. He had been ill for a year after the experience in Pennsylvania, and after his recovery, worked as a day laborer in the fields, going timidly about and striving to conceal his hands. Although he did not understand what had happened, he felt that the hands must be to blame. Again and again, the fathers of the boys had talked of the hands.
"Keep your hands to yourself,"
the saloon keeper had roared, dancing with fury in the schoolhouse yard. Upon the veranda of his house by the ravine, Wing Biddlebaum continued to walk up and down until the sun had disappeared and the road beyond the field was lost in the gray shadows. Going into his house, he cut slices of bread and spread honey upon them. When the rumble of the evening train that took away the express cars loaded with the day's harvest of berries had passed and restored the silence of the summer night, he went again to walk upon the veranda. In the darkness, he could not see the hands, and they became quiet. Although he still hungered for the presence of the boy, who was the medium through which he expressed his love of man, the hunger became again a part of his loneliness and his waiting. Lighting a lamp, Wing Biddlebaum washed the few dishes soiled by his simple meal, and setting up a folded cot by the screen door that led to the porch, prepared to undress for the night. A few stray white breadcrumbs lay on the cleanly washed floor by the table. Putting the lamp upon a low stool, he began to pick up the crumbs, carrying them to his mouth one by one with unbelievable rapidity. In the dense blotch of light beneath the table, the kneeling figure looked like a priest engaged in some service of his church. The nervous, expressive fingers, flashing in and out of the light, might well have been mistaken for the fingers of the devotee going swiftly through decade after decade of his rosary. And those are our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed Sophistication and Departure. From Winesburg, Ohio, by Sherwood Anderson. And that is also the end of the series. I hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.